Thank you for tuning in to Not Suitable for Anyone. As a reminder, if you'd like to financially support the show, don't! Just help other people find us by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, or just telling a friend. If you do want to put your hard-earned dollars to work to support our mission, here's what you can do. Buy or rent movies. Redbox, iTunes, Vudu, it doesn't matter, hell, even an old-fashioned Blu-ray. Leave a review on Letterboxd or Amazon and tell them that you heard about it right here on
Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's episode 44 of Not Suitable for Anyone. It's me, your host, Patrick Anderson. No one else. There's no one else on the show. There's no one else that does it. It's just me. And my wonderful guests, which I have a fantastic guest lined up for today. And I feel like I'm talking kind of fast this morning. I feel like I'm a little hyped up. And that's because I don't have a ton of time. I was a little late getting this episode out and ready. And I am kind of scrambling between projects, so I'm gonna have to keep it short. It's not gonna be too fancy. I don't think I'm gonna have time to like compile audio clips and stuff like that, but I did still want to, you know, provide an update as to some of the stuff we've talked about in the past, and you know, highlight a couple of new projects that I'm tracking, and maybe if there's time, talk about some of the weird shit that I've been watching, because it has been a wild fucking week. So, first off the bat, really big news. I'm really excited about this. I talked to you guys a couple weeks back about the crowdfunding project for Fat Fleshy Fingers from Steven Stull, who is the creator behind the Sick and Wrong Film Festival right here in Orlando, Florida. And he created the Fat Fleshy Fingers Kickstarter as a way to fund an anthology feature that he's putting together with alumni from the Sick and Wrong Film Festival. So all of the filmmakers involved in that project are former participants of the Sick and Wrong Film Festival, which is a film festival that highlights weird and low-budget kind of outsider movies. The kind of shit that I really, really love. And I'm really excited that now that I've learned about this festival, and I'm going to be checking that out as soon as they get back to, you know, doing actual festivals. But for now, I was really excited about this Kickstarter, and goddamn, it came down to the fucking wire. I was really nervous because I know a lot of the filmmakers involved. Michael Epstein, who I am going to try to get on the show, and Sophia Cassiola, who has already been on the show. They're great, great people. And I just really wanted to see this happen. They're going to be, of course, you know, producing a segment along with a bunch of other filmmakers. So it's really exciting. And so it came down right down to the wire, like within hours. I think within like 2 hours of the deadline, and they just creeped over that $15,000 mark for their all or nothing goal. So $15,177. That's the final tally on that, and there's some great, great perks there. So if you if you're a part of that, thank you. If you heard about it here, that's awesome. That makes me really happy. But either way, it was successful. I was promoting it a lot. If you follow me on socials, I was probably, you know, kind of pretty annoying about it. But I was really excited about this one. I really want to see it happen. So I was pumping it up every opportunity I got, and they're getting funded, so that's really exciting. Now, the other one that I talked about recently that is still going on is Mental Health and Horror. You can still pledge to that one. There's about 3 weeks left to go. They're doing really well. They are about 2/3 of the way to their goal. They have $21,000 raised out of a $30,000 goal. That is a documentary from Jonathan Barkin, all about the connection between mental health and the positive impacts horror films can have on mental health. It's a great topic. It's a great idea. And I'm really excited about that one. And good for those guys. They're doing really well. They haven't hit their goal yet, but they are well on their way. So check that out also on Kickstarter, Mental Health and Horror, a documentary. Now, I said I would have something new for you guys, and I do. There's a short that I talked about several months ago that was called Silent Shadow. I talked about it back on episode 36, so maybe go check that one out, or just go to YouTube and look up Silent Shadow. It's a short that is based on The Last of Us. It's only a couple minutes long. It's about 3 minutes long, but it's really good. It's really interesting, and it's made by a couple of students from the Detroit area, Yolit Rios and Gary J. So why did I take that detour to talk about Silent Shadow? Well, because this new crowdfunding project that I'm looking at is from those same two filmmakers, Gary and Yolit, are working on a new Western short called Lucky Lucy, following a black cowgirl as she's on her way to collect a bounty from an infamous troublemaker. So, you know, this is an interesting idea. They're trying to bring more black representation to the screen in general, obviously, and trying to bring more black representation in Westerns, which is an interesting thing. They are running this fundraiser on GoFundMe. So, you know, looking for about $20,000. I want to get more details from you guys. You can find them on Instagram and stuff. I'll put all those links in the show notes as always. And I'm working out a time right now with Gary to try and have you know, some of the directors, writers, producers for this short come on the show and talk about it. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. I hope to have some more details to share with you guys soon, but I'll put a link to their GoFundMe. Again, it's called Lucky Lucy, and you can find that, like I said, on GoFundMe. So, okay, so again, trying to keep things short this week, but I did want to go ahead and mention that project and kind of plant that seed. I should have more details on that, you know, in the coming weeks. But still, in the meantime, go check it out, Lucky Lucy on GoFundMe. You can read some of the details there on what it is and support some new, young sort of, you know, up and coming filmmakers that are just getting started out. It's the kind of thing I really love about doing this show. Is getting to meet people that are really still just sort of like learning the process and learning the business, along with getting to meet people that have made, you know, like multiple feature films. So, so that's Lucky Lucy. GoFundMe. Okay. Now, we had a trailer and a press release come out this week from Wild Eye Releasing, from the director of Velocipastor, Brendan Steer, who you might have heard on this show. You can find him on episode number, 15. It was a long time ago. Episode 15, go back and listen to my interview with Brendan Steer. He actually made and finished a movie prior to The Velocipastor called Animosity. It even won awards at Buffalo Dreams. And I guess for some reason just never got a release until now. But it is being released by Wild Eye. I hope to be able to see it soon. I have requested the screener, and I'm going to try to get Brendan back on the show to talk about that. But in the meantime, the trailer for Animosity is out, and you can watch it. It's very different. Tonally, 180 degrees different, I think, than Velocipastor. So it's really interesting to see, you know, sort of where he started. It still looks very good. You know, even, you know, for a first film or for, you know, an early film that precedes even the Velocipastor, you know, Velocipastor looked great. This looks really good. You know, especially for a low budget movie. So I'm really excited about it, but, yeah, so you can check that out. I'll put a link to the trailer in the show notes. But yeah, Animosity, from Brendan Steer, coming soon from Wild Eye Releasing. I think that comes out in July. So, okay. Now, I promised you guys I might talk for a few minutes about my week. And I'm going to tie this back in with Fat Fleshy Fingers. And one of the perks that I got there is for $25, you could yell at Michael Epstein. Michael Epstein is part of the filmmaking team with Sophia Cassiola. They directed Clickbait. They directed Blood of the Tribbids and Magnetic. And they have an forthcoming movie called The Once and Future Smash, which I'm really looking forward to. And they're going to be working on Fat Fleshy Fingers. So for $25, you could write a tirade, a rant, and Sophia will film herself yelling at Michael, and then they'll send you the video. So that's really that was really fun and stupid, and I figured, okay, I'll throw an extra $25 in my pledge and get that just for fun. So apropos of that, I was catching up on Michael and Sophia's podcast, the Launch Over podcast, which, you know, I think is worth checking out, especially if you're interested in their films and sort of what's going on with them, and sometimes they just ramble and whatnot, kind of like I do. So it's a good podcast. Check them out. But I was catching up on a few episodes from way back that I just hadn't listened to yet, and Michael was talking about this movie called Voyage of the Rock Aliens. It's a musical from the 80s about these alien life forms that come to this small town and play in this like battle of the bands type thing. It's really, really bizarre. It's like Grease meets Killer Clowns from Outer Space, sort of, except there's not really like big costumes. But there's all these other side plots too, because there's like these mental patients that have escaped from an asylum, and they're terrorizing people with chainsaws. And there's this whole like boy band gang thing, so with these rivalries, it's almost like a West Side Story type of thing. And there's the girl who wants to sing, but her boyfriend won't let her sing, and it's really strange. And it manages to pack in so many musical song and dance numbers, along with all of these really bizarre and strange side plots, and yet somehow it still wraps up in an hour and a half. I don't quite get it, but you can check that out. I'm pretty sure it was on Tubi TV, so I recommend it. As you know, as an oddity, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, if you like the kind of movies that I watch, it's probably worth checking out. It's probably worth your time. You know, it's not horror per se, but there are horror moments for sure. There's this whole sequence with Michael Berryman, I think that's his name, Berryman, the guy from The Hills Have Eyes. With a chainsaw, he plays this, you know, escaped mental patient, and he's wearing this very like stereotypical, like black and white striped like prison outfit. And you know, he's going around with a chainsaw, like trying to murder people, and it's hilarious. It's really bizarre. It doesn't make a ton of sense. Plot lines just wrap up because the movie is done, and so even though the characters haven't like shown any kind of growth or anything, they just decide, oh, you know, I'm going to be, you know, this person now because the movie's over and they need to be. So, yeah, so there's that. It's out of control, but Voyage of the Rock Aliens. I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm trolling a little bit. When I say I gave it 5 stars on Letterboxd, I did give it 5 stars. I mean, yes, I'm trolling, but also like the songs are really good. The songs are actually really impressive in the choreography. This thing was not cheap to make, I don't think. There's a lot going on. So Voyage of the Rock Aliens, but that started me, and this is where I'm getting into my rant on Michael. And my rant for Michael is going to involve this somehow, because this sent me down. I started chatting with him after that, and he started talking about this other movie called The Apple. And this just sent me down this whole rabbit hole of obscure 80s rock musicals, which culminated in, after The Apple, I watched Rock and Rule, and then Streets of Fire, which those are both awesome also. Rock and Rule is actually, like, I think, like the one out of the four of these that you know, like I would legitimately recommend to people. I kind of do, but I don't really understand like why it wasn't successful, because it's actually really well made. All of these are really well choreographed and stuff. It's just that some of them don't necessarily work as movies. But The Apple is batshit bananas. And I just could not believe, you know, what was happening and the wild twists that this movie takes. It's so fucking strange. So my 25-word rant at Michael is going to involve this rabbit hole somehow that he caused me to fall into. And I haven't exactly figured out entirely, you know, what I want to say. And of course, it's very tongue-in-cheek, because I had a blast watching all these movies. They're all great. Voyage of the Rock Aliens, The Apple, Rock and Rule, which is available on YouTube for free, legally from the distributor, and then Streets of Fire, which is on Netflix. These are all worth watching for various reasons. Rock and Rule is legitimately good. Like I was saying, Streets of Fire is pretty rad also. And it's got a very young Willem Dafoe, a very young Bill Paxton, and a very young Diane Lane. I think they said somewhere, I read Diane Lane was like 17 years old in this film. So yeah, those are all awesome. But Voyage of the Rock Aliens and The Apple are both just completely fucking bananas. So I'm sure I'm going to come up with something around that. It's all in good fun. You know, Michael, if you're listening, yeah, I love you. I think you're awesome. And, you know, it's all in good fun, and it's all, you know, just in service of entertainment and to get this movie made. So anyway, a little bit of a different show today, and I'm sorry, it was mostly just, you know, me rambling, but got a really good conversation coming up after the break. This is really exciting. I've actually been sitting on this one for a long time because I fucked up when I went on vacation, and I wasn't able to edit this into an episode for that week, so I ended up skipping a week, and I had to get the timely push out last week because of the festival thing. So anyway, enough, you know, behind the curtain. Josh Stifter sat down with me, and we had a very good, very long conversation about his career in making feature films, which somewhat started when he went on a reality show called Rebel Without a Crew. If that name sounds familiar, yeah, that's, it was a Robert Rodriguez show that he shot and put on his El Rey, I think it's called El Rey, network. You can still find it on Apple TV, the entire season. It's a really good show. I think it's, I don't know, like 10 episodes, 8-10 episodes, something like that. It's a really good show. And where these like five like filmmakers came together in Austin, Rodriguez gave them $7,000 each, which was his production budget for El Mariachi, and told them to go make their movie. And then they filmed it all, you know, and their trials and tribulations and stuff. They had like 2 weeks to shoot. They had, you know, like, you know, they had to cut a trailer together. They had to do all these little things, just like you would have challenges in a reality show. But it wasn't like a competition. It was really more of a collegial environment. Anyway, really cool stuff. He had a film that came out of it, went to festivals. It's now available. There's a Blu-ray coming out soon. It's called The Good Exorcist. It's really, really funny. If you like really gross, really wacky B movies, you know, over the top acting and over the top gore and stuff like that, you know, it's really kind of your bag. Metal music, all that kind of stuff, you know, charismatic sort of over the top people, really cool cars, like classic cars and stuff. The Good Exorcist, really cool movie. I like it a lot. It's a lot of fun. He also has a new one called Grey Woods Plot, which is a very, I guess you'd call it, like, I describe it, he used like terms like a Dr. Frankenstein type story. You know, it felt very much like a Island of Dr. Moreau type of thing to me, about these monster hunters that are looking for, you know, these lost creatures and cryptids and stuff like that. That is hitting festivals later this summer, I believe, or at least later this year. I don't exactly know where or when yet. I hope to find out soon. And then he just wrapped up production on a new one called Scumbag, which was shot, you know, during quarantine, where he basically made it himself in his house. I think he stars in it. He shot it. And so anyway, Josh Stifter, really cool guy, makes some rad movies. So stick around after the break and check out that conversation coming up next.
Just whatever you want to talk about, I'm down to chat.
All right, man. That sounds great. Josh Stifter, filmmaker, director of The Good Exorcist, Greywood's Plot, and the forthcoming... what's the name of your next one that just slipped my mind?
Scumbag, the movie I'm doing. It was actually... Scumbag's an interesting one because it was a movie that I wrote far before any of this lockdown or quarantine stuff happened, all based on this concept where, like, I was on this reality show, Rebel Without a Crew, where I made a movie for $7,000, which is total BS. It wasn't really $7,000. Like, that number is, when you're in the no budget film zone, no one talks about the fact that it's all nonsense. Like, what do you count in your budget? On a big budget movie, you count everything, right? But do I count my friends driving themselves out? Do I count their gas? You know, do I count hard drives that I had laying around that I started filling up with footage? Like, I, you know, there's all these little things that you kind of grab from. My camera. I'm not buying my camera to shoot Scumbag. I bought it. Actually, I got it for filming a wedding a long time ago. Instead of getting paid, I bartered for a camera. And And so that's what I'm shooting Scumbag with. So do I count that in my budget? But, you know, with Rebel Without a Crew, they said $7,000. Well, we had to rent equipment. That was $2,500 of our budget right there, which no one out here has to go buy, rent their camera or their equipment. You can use what you have, use the lights you have around you, use your cell phone, use whatever you can get, like whatever the best camera you can get your hands on is. So I don't know. The $7,000 thing is kind of a sham to me, but with Scumbag, you know, but I always felt like Rebel Without a Crew was kind of BS. The real Rebel Without a Crew was a movie one guy would make in his basement by himself. So I decided to try that. And I wrote this script back in 2019 or 2018, something like that. I sent it to my cohort, my producer, best friend since kindergarten, Father Gill in The Good Exorcist, Daniel Degnan. And I was like, hey, man, don't give me any advice because I want to make this movie by myself. But read this and tell me what you think. Just, is it good? Should I do it? Should I not? So I sent it to him. He read it and he's like, hey, man, I want to get together for lunch. So we got together and he goes, dude, don't do it. Don't make it yourself. This is too good. I want to work on it with you. I don't want you to do this movie by yourself. So I set it aside and we had everything set up. We were planning to film it. We were putting together cast and crew, and then COVID hit. And I called him and I was like, dude, I just got to do this one myself. So I started on it. And through the last year, I've been filming this movie by myself. I grew my fingernails and my hair out for it. And my wife was not happy with the way I looked for a while. But yeah, I've been filming it by myself and it's been a blast. So Scumbag, that's the one I'm working on now.
All right. Awesome. Saw the teaser earlier on online. So I'll definitely drop a link to that. The Good Exorcist was, I guess, your first feature, and that's the feature that came out of, you know, working on the Rebel Without a Crew series. So just sort of in general, I mean, what was that like? I mean, that's got to be in a lot of ways a life changing experience.
It was, but the funny thing was, I had actually started filming Greywood's Plot, my second movie, before we went to film The Good Exorcist. So for my 30th birthday, I had realized that I had one thing on my bucket list, like literally one thing. You know, everyone has their bucket list of stuff. All I ever wanted to do in my life was make a feature film. Like, that's it. And I had made a whole bunch of shorts, hundreds of cartoons. I had worked on children's cartoons for 8 years at that point. I was a director of animation and stuff like that. And all I wanted to do well, the only reason I went to school for animation was to make a movie. Like, I just wanted to learn how to make a movie. And, you know, obviously I also was like, well, hopefully I can get work and get paid to do this kind of stuff. But I really just wanted to make a movie. And then I turned 30 and I had kids, I had a wife, I had a mortgage, I had a good job, I had all this stuff. And I'm like, I didn't do the one thing. The easiest thing was going to make a movie. How did I not? How did I fail at my one bucket list item? So for my 31st birthday or 30th birthday, one of the two, Daniel, my buddy Keith Radical, and another friend Strauss, who wasn't actually invited. He just showed up, which is fine. It was awesome. We went out in the woods and started filming this outline I had for a movie. For my entire life, I had this idea about a movie where Daniel is like a Dr. Frankenstein character and he turns me into a Spider-Man. That was like the plot of this idea. I just thought that would be cool. I'm terrified of spiders, so I thought it would be cool to become the thing that scares me. And so I had this outline, this general concept. We went out and started filming and it was awful. We came back with the footage and I was like, oh my God, we have like an eighth of a movie here. Like, this is not a movie. We are not improv guys. Like, we're not good at just making it up. These are rambly sequences and I don't know what's going on. And then I had done this animation that I sent to Robert Rodriguez and was like, hey man, it had Michael Parks's voice. And it was right after Michael Parks had passed. And I was like, I don't know if you guys could do anything with this, but I made this cartoon that I just think you should see because it has Michael Parks in it. And he's like, I like it, but I can't do anything with it. But I love this other cartoon you did. Can I buy this? And he bought this Tim the Terrible cartoon from me. And while I was out there talking about that cartoon, they mentioned Rebel Without a Crew. And I sort of stumbled into this application for that show. And I was one of the first ones to apply based on having gone to that. And somehow I ended up on the show. I don't know how. I was the one of the like 5,000 people that applied. I was one of the five that actually got on. But I think it all boils down to on the application, there was this one question. There's like a ton of stupid questions on the application. There was one that said, what is your spirit animal? And I said, beaver, because I work hard and say damn a lot. And I think that's the only reason I got on the show. They're like, oh, he's an idiot. We need an idiot on this show. And they picked me. So I went on the show and then I ended up, you know, Daniel and I wrote the script. They had called me and were like, hey man, do you have a script? Can you send out the script for your the movie you think you can do for $7,000? And I was like, oh yeah, I have a script. I'll send it out. Can I have like a week to clean it up? They were like, yeah, you know what? Everyone else is sending their scripts in 2 weeks. Send yours when everyone else sends theirs. I didn't have a script. I lied. I had no script. So Daniel and I just started writing like crazy. We like started digging through stuff that we had. We were like, what can we fit in a suitcase if they're going to fly us out to Austin? And we didn't actually know we were going to Austin. When this whole thing was happening, they didn't know the rules of the show. This was a first season thing. No one had any idea what was going on. So I actually wrote the script for a bed and breakfast. I wrote it for like something that I would have in Minnesota. If I was going to film this movie in Minnesota, what would I do? And then, you know, they told me they were flying us out to Austin. And I'm like, well, I'm going to have to change my whole script because there is literally an entire chunk of the movie that took place in a basement. They don't have basements in Texas. So I was like, I don't know. I have to change this whole thing. And that's sort of, you can see that in Rebel Without a Crew, that I'm constantly just like rewriting scenes, changing characters. In the script, Stanley was supposed to be basically this like Jack Black, like portly, like Jack Black in Orange County. That's sort of how I had written Stanley. And then Avery showed up and he's this like handsome, goofy looking mustached guy. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm rewriting that character to fit him. And then, you know, it just happened to be that Avery is this wonderful like improviser and was able to kind of find the character on his own, you know, with Daniel and I. We would sort of work with him and the three of us would sort of figure out what that character of Stanley was going to become. And yeah, but then just, you know, the experience of being on Rebel Without a Crew was, it was my film school. That's the only way to put it. It was like being thrown into the water and being forced to swim and everyone is sort of watching you and laughing, but no one is going to help. And so Daniel and I just kind of drowned together and somehow made it back to the shore and came out with a movie that we're very proud of, even with all of its rough edges and You know, we had to make the whole movie that we shot over 14 days, but we had to actually finish the whole movie, edit it, everything, do the entire process in like 2.5 months. So that included hundreds. I mean, I think I did 230 visual effects or something like that in the movie. Because, and only 100 of them do you actually see. Another 100 was removing reality crew from the background. Because of course their best shot is being in my shot. You know, they want to film me, so they want to be across from me as I'm filming whatever I'm filming, which meant walking into my shots constantly. And we didn't have time to do, you know, there was no ADR, there was no pickups later, there was nothing. We shot over 14 days, and then it was like, all right, go back to Minnesota and make a thing out of this. And we did. We're very happy with what we came out with. But then from there, it was life-changing in as much as that getting that first movie done was the kick in the ass to go like, oh, I'm just going to keep doing this. So since then, that was 3 years ago. And since then, I finished Greywood's plot, and that's going to be hitting some film festivals in the next few months, some really great film festivals. And then, but I can't announce yet. One of the worst parts of film festivals is you can't announce them until they want you to. So you sit on these secrets. Oh, yeah. And it's awful. And I am a terrible secret holder. I am like the most open person on the planet. So keeping secrets, oh, it's awful. And then Scumbag, I'm wrapping up filming probably this week, maybe next week. And then I will be just editing my ass off on that, trying to get it done, and no idea what I'm going to do with it. These three Rebel Without a Crew features are movies that I didn't think about who the audience was or how I was going to distribute them. I just went, let's go do these things. And I've learned a ton, but I feel like I've gone to the greatest film school ever, but it's just been go, go, go.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. And before Rebel Without a Crew, I think you had made some short films, but hadn't finished a feature yet. And yeah, I guess I'm curious, like how they selected who was going to be on. Like, did you have to? You said you didn't have a script, or did you have to pitch them a story or anything like that? Or were they just looking more for trying to find you know, the right people that they wanted to assemble for their show?
I think it was a mix of things. So I actually sent in a pitch the day that they asked me to send the script, where I got the call that was like, hey, can you send us something? I was on my way to work, and or I was just getting up and ready for work, and I got the email that's asked if I could send the stuff. And so I whipped together on the bus on the way to work. I took the like Metro Transit, and on the Metro Transit, I photoshopped, I edited this poster of a bunch of different items. It was like a crucifix, a Super 8 camera, a gun, a flask. I don't know. There was like a bunch of random things. And then Daniel designed the Good Exorcist logo. And then I put together like a list of characters. I did a, what do you call that? Like an act paradigm, where I broke down like the act structure of the movie, like opens with this in act one, we end with this, where we get to the B&B in act two, evil starts to happen. And I broke down how the whole movie would sort of play out in a really easy way. And then I wrote a bunch of random scenes. And this, I did this in an hour on the bus. I just wrote out all of this stuff. And then I wrote scenes where I was like, I have no idea, but I knew my wife had a teddy bear. So I was like, ah, evil teddy bear pukes in his face. I have no idea. And so I just wrote down these random sequences and sent them off to, and I sent that off. It was like a 4-page PDF or 3-page PDF. And they read that. And that's when they were like, oh, this is awesome. Can you send us this script over? And I was like, oh yeah, a week. But that all came together super fast. But that's what they wanted, was just like a general idea of what your movie was. Some people, I think, actually sent in scripts. Alejandro sent in his short film Monday and pitched it as like, this is the short, I want to turn this into a feature. So everyone kind of did their own thing, I think, and had their own way of pitching. And a lot of people had scripts, but I think a lot of people wrote their scripts for what they wanted to do. They had written them before the idea had come up to do this with Rebel. And a lot of those scripts they looked at, and you know, Robert read a lot of them and went, this, how they're never going to be able to do this with $7,000. They're not thinking inside of the box. And I even in my script, I would write like little cliff notes where I was like, use tentacles from, you know, Chum or whatever, from another short film I did. So then they could actually kind of reference what I was thinking and how it would be possible to do it for no budget. I think that's basically what it boiled down to was they were pretty open at communicating with the people that they were looking into picking at, you know, once we hit the, like, once they found the top 200, they were very like, okay, well, how would you do this? And we would get questions sent all the time and we'd have to send in things on time. And I think a lot of people, they just didn't send in on time. And then they'd be like, okay, well, that person's out. You had to be on their schedule, which just proved that you could do the movie on their schedule.
Yeah, because they got, like, I was just sort of getting into that, and I'm about halfway through the series right now, and, you know, they're getting into, you know, like, the TV show production crew needs to go to lunch. So you have to shut production yep. down, even though you want to keep shooting, because it's your feature. You're, like, also, you know, you're directing a feature, but then you're also, you know, a part of someone else's production at the same time. It's a very, it seems like a very strange hardest part.
Yeah, that was easily the hardest part. Like, you don't understand, like, it's hard to wrap your head around trying to be creative and trying to put yourself into this world and figure out your script and be, you know, figuring out your lighting, everything. I did everything myself. And trying to do all that while also pandering to this reality show, you know, going on their union lunch breaks, making sure that you're done before their unions are up. There was at one point I actually didn't wear shoes to set. And because I don't wear shoes like ever. I'm that hippie weirdo. And I wear sandals a lot, or I just don't wear shoes at all. I walk around barefoot all the time. And one day I was like very adamant. I was in a mood, and I got up in the morning and I'm like, yeah, it's nice to be on a no budget movie, not wearing shoes to set today, making my independent movie by myself, not wearing shoes. And the reality crew was all like, yeah, Josh, we get it. You're not wearing shoes. You're very cool. Now leave us alone. And then I got out to set and they're like, oh, he's not wearing shoes. Like, this is breaking union rules. Like, he can't do that. And I just sat there like, hey, I'm not in a union movie, you guys. They're like, yeah, but you're on a union show. And I'm like, okay, well, then you guys need to cut me some breaks to get around making this movie, because you're not obviously not letting me make my independent movie the way I would make it. So now you need to, cut me some breaks and stay out of my shots today. So it was very much like playing this back and forth game with the reality crew, which is to say, I love my reality crew. Like, I'm still very good friends with a lot of them. In fact, my producer on the show is in Greywood's plot. He plays my brother in my second movie. So I, you know, I'm good friends with a ton of the reality crew still. And but it was a back and forth of working together to make everything work.
Making a movie is hard enough. It just adds this like additional layer of complexity to it all.
And that's one of the things when I talk to people about making their first independent movie is take advantage of the fact that no one is telling you what to do. Like, you could do anything. You could get away with so much. And that's with Greywood's plot. That's very much what we did was, you know, took the stuff that I wouldn't have been allowed to do. We weren't allowed to do any sort of stunt. That means I couldn't climb a ladder. Like, there was one shot in The Good Exorcist where Daniel, who is 6'7" or something like that, and I'm 5'4" on a tall day. And Daniel and I, so we're like opposites. He's super tall, I'm super tiny. And there's a scene where he's supposed to be like laying out on the ground with a bullet hole in his head inside of this pentagram that he's dug into the ground. And I couldn't hold the camera high enough to be able to film him. So I wanted to climb up on this ladder. And they're like, no, you can't climb up on that ladder. And I was like, well, can I climb up like one step? They're like, okay, one step, we'll give you one step up. And so then I was like, all right, everyone get into place, rolling camera and action. And I just ran up to the top of the ladder and shot it while they all swarmed in on me. I'm like, oh, you said one. I thought you said the top. Oh, silly me. So I just played stupid a lot of the time. We did the same thing with the stunts when Daniel is throwing himself around the room with the teddy bear. They were like, he can't throw himself into the walls. He can't throw himself around the room. That would be a stunt. We need a paramedic on set if he's going to do that, or an EMT on set or whatever, if he's going to do that. And I'm like, okay, fine. But I'm going to be swinging, instead of him throwing himself around, I'm going to swing the camera around so it looks like fast motion. And so I need everyone to leave the room. And then everyone left the room. And I was just like, Daniel, do whatever you want to do. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not stopping you. And then he started throwing himself around the room. So that's how we got around stuff like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, because that's got to be... I almost feel like it would have been easier if they just gave you $7,000 and said, you know, go make your movie and come back.
Things about it that would have been, but there's things about it that would have been harder. For instance, like, I wouldn't have got the cast that I got. Like, that was very much, you know, the help of Beth Sepko setting up, you know, who was going coming out and calling up different agents and stuff like that. So we were provided a cast that, you know, I never would have met Avery if that's the method I would have taken. And Robert also, you know, let us use some of his props and stuff like that. And some of my favorite moments of the movie wouldn't have happened without, I mean, I picked props. I don't know if you've got to that part of the show, but there's a part where Robert lets us like kind of go through his prop house. And
yeah.
And I picked stuff that wasn't in the script. I just was like, you know what? A metal detector? That's stupid. I'm going to pick that and see if we can use it in the movie. And it's one of my favorite lines is when Stanley goes, I always wanted to be a metal detective. And it's such a stupid moment, but it makes me laugh so hard. And that was like, we just had this metal detector because I thought it looked cool. I picked it up. And then I gave it to Avery and I'm like, I don't know, do something funny with it in the background, I guess. In the script at that scene, Stanley was supposed to be picking his nose and like trying to flick a booger off of his finger. So it was like stuck and he's like, can't get it off and like flinging his hand around like an idiot while they're having this, you know, deep conversation about what happened, that was what's supposed to be happening in the background. And so I just gave him this medal that I'm like, the booger thing is stupid. This isn't funny enough. That's not the character. I want something goofier. How about you're walking around with the metal detector? And he's like, all right. And he started doing it. And then he just improv that line. I always wanted to be a metal detective and it still makes me laugh. So, you know, that's the thing that, you know, maybe something else would have come out of it. And Greywood's plot, which I think is a better movie. And I think it is more up. It's more in the vein of the kind of movie I want to make. In the future, that a lot of the good that happened from that was the fact that I had like complete and utter freedom. You know, we filmed it over 3 years when all is said and done. I actually filmed one of my favorite scenes in that movie 2 weeks before it was due for its first film festival. So I watched the movie one last time with my wife and I was supposed to be sending it out like 2 weeks later or a week later or something like that. And I was like, something's missing in this movie. And I sat down and sort of like figured it out and wrote this scene in an evening, called up Daniel and Strauss, and I was like, hey, can we find a location and go film this dinner sequence I wrote? And I wrote it, we went out, we filmed it in an evening, and I edited it. I took music from the rest of the movie. Curtis Hager had done this amazing score for Greywood's plot. And I just chopped up sort of the emotions from other moments, and it actually kind of bookends the movie perfectly using score throughout the movie. I sent it to Curtis and I'm like, hey man, is this cool? Like, is this stepping on your toes if I use just cues from the rest of the movie? And he listened to it and was like, oh, this is very good. Like, I like that this is the way it feels like it bookends the movie properly. And so, yeah, that's the kind of freedom I had versus The Good Exorcist. I wasn't allowed to do pickups. I had to do the whole movie from beginning to end, from the day I started writing till the day I sent it in for South by Southwest. It was like maybe 4 months tops. And, you know, that's just a huge turnaround time for something like that. So with independent film, you have this freedom when you're not inside of the box of something like Rebel. As much as I loved the experience and it pushed me and it forced me to go, if you can find that in yourself, you'll end up making a better movie.
Yeah. Wow. And that's not something, you know, that people think about when you're talking about, you know, when you're talking about limitations in shooting and making movies, you know, you tend to think about things like, oh, I can't afford this, or, you know, these stunts are too expensive or something like that. But you never really think about somebody telling you, you know, that you can't use a ladder you know, that your actor can't, you know, hit themselves against the wall or something. Like, you don't think about those kinds of more logistical restrictions. You know, those aren't usually what comes to mind. But that's navigating that is as much you know, part of filmmaking as anything else.
Yeah, and you put yourself in this box, but the bigger your budget gets, because I've worked on big budget things and small budget things, but the bigger the budget gets, the more you think you should be able to get away with, but the more everything starts to cost, and it makes you like sort of become dissatisfied and rush things and force something with budget versus creativity. And I like this concept of playing with creativity versus being forced to come up with a excuse to be crazy and do something different and weird. And like, that's why Scumbag has been such an interesting process, because trying to find ways to play two characters at the same time, or to even just something as simple as getting a dialogue out and explaining to the audience what's happening, is much more difficult, because I'm one person on screen with a camera that's, you know, I have a track that's like an automatic track. So the camera may be moving, but like, how do I explain that this character is sad without him saying to another character, "I'm sad"? So I having to think inside that box, but also just making it interesting. What's a fun scene that I can show that, so the audience isn't just bored watching me on screen do nothing for an hour? Like, that's not what I want. So trying to find ways to make something fun when I put myself inside of this box of, you have to make a movie where it's just you. Okay, what would anyone want to look at that's just me? All right, I have a toothache, and now I have to rip out my tooth by myself while trying not to breathe because I have to take my gas mask off. Like, that sort of thing it leads to a different creativity the more restrictions you put on yourself. Not to say that I would love a budget and love to get rid of those restrictions at some point, but having those restrictions has taught me a lot over the past few years.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. So I'm curious, and maybe this is kind of a difficult question because it seems like you kind of conceived of this idea for the show, but I guess how much about The Good Exorcist was sort of changed or influenced, you know, based on working with Robert Rodriguez and, you know, shooting in Texas?
A ton of it. I mean, from the first script that Daniel and I sort of, you know, slapped together till we finally got on set and started filming, and then into the edit and changing things even then, it's a completely different movie than the first script. I would actually love to go and shoot what the original script was at some point, because it's such a different movie based on, you know, the restrictions of what I was forced to work with, especially the time constraints. There's a lot you can do when you have time and you can actually think about, okay, what is this going to look like when it goes into the final edit? But there was moments where we were just like, I guess we have a parking lot. This is going to be hell. Like, I had no idea what hell was going to look like. And if I had my way, I would set up, you know, a giant green screen in a field and make it, you know, a big production where I'd take a whole evening, get a whole bunch of green screens, set them up, you know, like borrow from friends, find ways to make it work and make this huge field and turn that into hell. Well, I didn't have the time to do that. So it boiled down to going like, well, this is the parking lot where they shot Planet Terror. I guess this is cool. Let's film right here. And so we just decided, you know, I want Daniel to kneel where Bruce Willis stood. So that's sort of what happened, just based on the necessity of let's go. But the original script is, it's very, very different, and a lot changed, especially the characters. You know, I didn't know what my cast was going to look like. So I wrote the whole thing based on this concept that it may just be Daniel and I. Like, we may never have anyone else around, or we may only be able to get people for a day or two. And luckily we got them for a lot more than that. And they came out and they were willing to, you know, play in this world and work with the script and really kind of find the characters as we went. But I had no idea. I thought I was going to be getting, you know, like community college film school students in the movie. Like, I didn't know that I'd get people who could actually learn their lines. In fact, that was the funniest part was I had all of these things set up. I had an iPad set up with a teleprompter that I was bringing with just in case people had to like read their lines off camera. And I had all this stuff set up, and I was like, well, I know how to get the lines out of Daniel, but I don't know about everyone else. And then we got there and Daniel was like a fish out of water. He was not an actor before this and had no idea what he was doing and can't memorize lines as fast as they do and had to like totally kick up his game in 3 days. I remember the first 2 days, Daniel was so nervous he couldn't spit a line out. And then I gave him like $100. I probably came out of the budget. It either came out of the $7,000 budget, or we got like a per diem, you know, for like food to be on the show since we weren't working at the time. They were like, they gave us like $200 a week or something like that for food. And I may have just given Daniel my $200 for my per diem or something like that. And I was like, hey, Avery, Daniel, you two guys have to be best friends right now. Like, I need you guys to get along. So go out, get drunk. Avery, teach Daniel how to act in an evening. Let's do this thing. And Daniel and Avery went out to an improv show. Avery convinced Daniel to go up to an improv show in Austin. And Daniel got up on stage and actually won the improv show that night. and then the next day he came to set and like, it was a completely different person. He was memorizing his lines or at least getting the lines out. He had that confidence to just go like, okay, maybe the line isn't exactly as it is on the page, but at least all of the points are there and I can make something out of this.
Right. Yeah. And that was one of the things that I learned that surprised me, and you know, was that Daniel's not a professional actor, because he really kind of carries this movie. I mean, he's front and center for a good bit of it. And I think he gives a really fun, really energetic performance.
Yeah, he does. And then that's why going out into Grey Woods was so much fun, because he's such a different character in that movie. But he then had the confidence to just go for it. And the character of Doug Grey Woods is such a unique, original take on that sort of, I don't know, that sort of odd backwoods character. And it's really fun seeing Daniel work outside of his box and or play these different characters. And then we recently just did this short film called The First of November, where I had Daniel act with my 8-year-old, and it's a silly, fun short film about evil pumpkins, but I wanted my 8-year-old to be in it. So the two of them got to act off each other, and seeing Daniel with this like acting confidence and Max acting for his first time, but also like not having this predisposition that he couldn't do it, you know, telling him like, people memorize lines, Max, you can do this. He memorized, my 8-year-old memorized this like 5-sentence monologue and just gave it like instantly. And it was amazing. So there was this fun element of the two of them acting off of each other, where Daniel couldn't memorize 5 lines before The Good Exorcist. Now an 8-year-old is doing it, and Daniel's memorizing his lines and acting off of his 8-year-old. And there was just, I don't know, it was everything coming together in a really fun way.
Yeah, that's fun. That's really cool. I'll have to check that one out. I'm a big fan of short films.
Yeah, the First of November is it's a goofy one. It was hard, you know, we're in quarantine and everyone's locked down. We can't go make movies together this last winter. And we were so antsy to make something. I was like, I don't know, what if the three of us just get together and try to make something about killer? It was actually like right after November, Daniel messaged me and he was like, hey, I've got an idea. What if we did a movie about evil pumpkins? You have to get rid of the pumpkins the day after November. And before he had finished his sentence, I was like, here's the outline. Let's do this thing. And I had like visual effects figured out how we were going to do it. And it's really just an attempt for us. Our sort of dream project, if you couldn't tell from The Good Exorcist, is like a, you know, Gremlins, Ghoulies, Critters movie. Like, we love little monsters. I'm a huge fan of little monster movies. And so First of November was sort of our attempt at showing what our little monsters, it's like a proof of concept of what our little monster movie would look like.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. And yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff like that. And that's really neat. And that's one of the things I like about independent film, and in particular this sort of no budget range. You know, once you get below, you know, it used to be once you got below $1 million, but nowadays it's, you know, like once you get below like $30,000, you know, you're really extremely limited into, in, you know, what you can do. You can, your crew can't be, you know, it can't be too big. You can't have too many shooting days. Or, like you said, you have to, you know, spread things out over the course of, you know, of years sometimes, just to get everyone together and get all the shots that you need. But
yeah, and as a filmmaker, you have to be very open to, you have to understand that everyone on set that day is a filmmaker. Like, you can't force, you can't be a diva filmmaker when you're doing something like that. You very much have to be open to ideas and actually making it a creative process for everything, which has been extremely fun for me because, number one, it takes some of the pressure off of me because I, you know, when everyone gets involved, everyone comes up with ideas and suddenly we're all being creative and playing together. Versus, you know, some of the bigger budget sets I've been on, it's like no one wants to do anything because the director takes complete control and you're just like, I guess we'll just do what he says and half-ass it. When everyone is part of the creative process and feels they can put their stamp on that piece of art, they're so much more willing to just get crazy and do fun stuff.
Yeah, and I feel like you can tell, you know, you can tell when everyone's genuinely, you know, enjoying their time and having a good time with what they're doing, even though it's, you know, it's hard work and things go wrong and sometimes things don't work out the way that you want. You know, it's not just people, you know, punching a clock and, you know, saying, okay, these are my lines or whatever, these are the marks I'm going to hit. It's they're really enjoying the process itself. And that comes through in the final product. And that's something I enjoy, and I get more out of that than necessarily, you know, where does the story go? I mean, a lot of people, you know, tend to boil movies down to, you know, just their plot. Well, this happens and then this happens. And I'm like, okay, but you know, all these stories have been told, you know, show me some people that are just here trying to, you know, work together and create something new. Like that's what I really find, you know, exciting and entertaining.
Same. And I think that comes from, for me, I remember growing up and there were, you know, there were huge, all these huge concerts and huge bands and stuff like that. And I remember seeing a couple of high school kids in the neighborhood would just play music in their garage and they weren't very good. Like the songs weren't brilliant by any means. They were three chords, and looking back, they were probably two chords most of the time. The drummer could barely play and it was a mess, but there was something about the passion and drive to learn and feeling like I was part of the band. I was part of the experience of coming up with this stuff. Every mistake, every error, every time they had to restart, I loved that. Like, that was the fun of being a part of that experience versus going to see Metallica. Like, Metallica just played. Like, it's fun, it's great, but that's an experience everyone has all the time. And it's kind of undeniably good. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way you can go, it's not rough around the edges. It's a huge production versus those punk bands who were just figuring it out. I just felt so much more connected to that sort of creative process. And so when we started making The Good Exorcist and Greywood's Plot and now Scumbag, all three of these, one of the things I've been very particular about is that I don't force a lack of rough edges, that I allow the audience to see the rough edges a little bit here and there, because I really want it to be, which sounds like a cop out, like I'm going like, no, I meant to make a crappy movie. But in reality, I really want people who, everyone can go watch Quiet Place too. Like, anyone can go watch these big budget movies, but it takes a certain person who really wants something, I don't know, like that punk band mentality or that garage band mentality of filmmaking that we're able to do now because we are able to buy cameras that don't cost us a ton to make, just like those kids bought $200, you know, Gibson ripoffs, and we're able to make music in their garage. So that's sort of where my head has been at. And I personally like those kind of movies. And I like that sort of rough around the edges, show me what you can do with nothing style.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Same here. I've always liked that. One of my crusades is, you know, that bad movies are actually better than good movies. Because if you know, if you take like the one or two things out of a good movie, that you know, that make it good, then what's left is usually pretty boring, because it's pretty much, it's safe and sort of by the numbers. But with, you know, with a quote unquote bad movie, with, you know, something that's just made with no budget and by people who, you know, aren't being told by, you know, studio executives what to do, you even when you strip away, you know, the crazier elements, you're still getting something that's unique.
Yeah, that was one of the big things with The Good Exorcist, was there was a lot of moments that, you know, Daniel and I went back and forth while I was in the edit, figuring out how I wanted the movie to play out. There were a lot of moments where we were like, we could cut this scene. Like, there's no scene in that movie. Very few scenes are necessities to keeping the story going or keeping, you know, people, keeping things moving. And there are lots of moments where we were like, ah, we could cut this, we could cut this, we could cut this, and make a really solid 60-minute movie, like a really solid 60-minute movie. But I was like, I want people to see the mistakes and the things that we tried and the things that we put in the movie, that, you know, things that maybe didn't work for them, but that's okay, because they'll learn something from seeing that, and we can analyze why it didn't work, and in the future build off of that and what did work about that scene. Maybe you don't like the scene as a whole, but maybe there's something about that scene that really resonates with someone else. And that's one of the things that really clicked with me watching The Good Exorcist with an audience, was because it is no budget and takes weird little risks and does things very offbeat here and there, I would hear from the audience what their favorite scenes were or what they liked or what resonated, and realize how, when a movie does take those kind of risks or does weird things, how those weird things will resonate with people completely differently. Like, one of my favorites is the character of Mrs. Willows, which is completely polarizing for people. Either people hate that B-movie acting, that over-the-top performance, that really she goes really big. And that was totally intentional, because I wanted it to feel like a midnight, or I really wanted it to feel like one of those movies that would play on regular television on like a Sunday afternoon, or like basic cable on a Sunday afternoon, where you just see a movie where you're like, how did this get made? And why is it playing right now? But I can't look away. And now it's my favorite movie, like, ever. And like, that's what I wanted to make, were those movies that I would sit and I'd be drawing as a kid, and they'd come on and I would be like, oh, no one ever talked about this movie, and now I'm kind of obsessed with it. And then I, you know, later I look up reviews and find out, this is pre-internet, later on I find out like people hated this movie when it came out, and it was one of my favorites. So, you know, it shows that one man's trash is another man's treasure, and I'm totally okay making trash.
No, that's great. I love it, man. Absolutely love it. I also want to pivot and talk a little bit about the location, because your script, or at least what we see, you know, it seems, you know, very much designed to be able to shoot on a low budget, where most of the movie already takes place in one location. But you found a shooting location that actually incorporated several elements that in the movie's geography are, you know, are sort of nowhere near each other, but it looks like, yeah, you know, you guys had basically one place that you had to go every day to shoot, you know, most of your scenes.
Yeah, we only filmed 2 days. We filmed at different locations, both of the Fridays that we filmed. We filmed at the house that we were staying at for Rebel Without a Crew one day, and I filmed in my bedroom, and then on the exterior of the house as well. And then another day we filmed at Troublemaker Studio in the parking lot, for the Father Gill Goes to Hell sequence. And but the rest of it we filmed, I needed a church, and I needed a place for a stretch of road for Father Gill to dance. Actually, that's not even true. The original script opened up with Father Gill drinking wine at a bar, and I changed it to that because the bar wanted like $200, and I was like, nah, we'll just open it up at the church itself, and it actually makes way more sense, and it looks awesome when the doors swing open and Father Gill steps out of a church. But it originally opened up with a bar and Father Gill sipping on wine and then walking out the door as he finishes his wine, because there was like this underlying theme that Father Gill might be an alcoholic in the original script. There's a lot of things that just sort of fell by the wayside, like we turned the whole flask thing that stayed in the movie. Originally, it was supposed to be holy alcohol. Like, he was supposed to be blessing like vodka. And at the end, he was going to, when he kills the Bible, originally he threw the flask up in the air, shot the holy water on it, lit on fire. But they wouldn't let me do any effects like that, so I wasn't able to do that. So we just changed it to the crucifix. And then I kept the flask because I was like, well, if we ever do a sequel, I can do that beat in the sequel. But we ended up getting that location and it worked perfectly. The Bonnie BK wrote her grandma's house script was in this big house. And I actually almost took that house. I originally had, that house and I had I had picked up the house and the ranch. So I had both of those. And then I end up giving Bonnie the house because I'm like, I think I'll just go with the ranch. It makes more sense that they'd be at a ranch. And I just like the idea of having this big location. Plus, it has a church. So I know I can film any of the church sequences. Or if I have to make up a scene to fill time, I can make that up and just have another scene with Father Gill at the church. So I took that location. And they only charged me like $1,000 or something like that. I don't even remember what they charged me to have that ranch for 2 weeks. But the thing that they don't talk about in the show is that the Pierce Brosnan show, The Sun, it was an AMC show, actually came in and started destroying my set while I was filming. They were like tearing the whole thing apart.
Oh, wow.
So there's a moment in Rebel Without a Crew where they make it look like Brittany isn't delivering her lines. Like she's stumbling over her lines. And it's like one of my only dramatic moments where it's like Josh is having trouble getting his actors to perform. And the reality of that was she did her lines just fine. It was actually, she had this huge monologue that she just ran through and she messed up a few times, but not enough to make me actually give a shit. Like, I don't care if you mess up your lines a couple times. As long as you spit out like a piece of it that I can use, take a pause and spit out the rest later. I'll chop it up. You know what I mean? Like, it's not one take. So the thing that actually was making me mad and causing for the distraction was they were running a nail gun outside of my bedroom or of the bedroom we were filming in. And I was like just about to snap and whatever, because I was told that that Pierce Brosnan's show wouldn't be showing up. But it led to funny jokes because the running gag became like Pierce Brosnan was always going to come and shut us down at any given moment.
I was going to say that explains the credit. There was like a special credit that was like special thanks to everyone else except Pierce Brosnan.
Yep, which is a running theme in every single movie I will ever make. My dream is that someday I can get Pierce Brosnan to play God or the devil in a Father Gill sequel. Like, that would be the most amazing thing in the world if Pierce would come out and play God or the devil. The best would be, I just have this dream of making this movie where Pierce Brosnan plays the devil and Francis McDormand plays God. Like, that's like the perfect cast of all time. Those two bickering back and forth would be so fun to me.
Oh, but wow. Yeah.
But the that was the running gag, though. A plane would fly over and it's like, oh, looks like Pierce is diving in. James Bond here to mess up our movie, staring at us with his golden eye.
That's funny. So you brought up two things I want to circle back to. One was, let's talk about the opening sequence first, because I think that is, it is a much better scene, and it's a much more unique introduction to Father Gill. He's got the Walkman, yeah. And you know, the metal music is playing and he's just dancing down the street, and it really sort of establishes his character right off the bat, I think, much better.
Odd persona. Yeah. Yeah, he's, well, I mean, so Daniel's a tall, lanky dude. And I had this like joke in my head that I thought would be funny for reality TV, where I would make my cast like constantly dance without music. So there's like four dance sequences in The Good Exorcist, which no one really thinks. There's like the dance in the bar. There's the dance by the car when Maria and Father Gill are dancing there. And then there's Father Gill dancing across the street or to the exorcism. And I feel like originally there might've been one more and I cut it, but those scenes happened in the movie simply because I was like, how funny would it be if this director constantly is saying like, all right, now everyone dance. I can't play music because the reality show won't let us, but just dance. So I wrote those sequences based on that, and they ended up working great. They're super fun in the movie, but you would have no idea that there's no music playing through any of them. But that's why, like, all of the dances are all awkward and, like, really smooth until the Father Gil and Maria one, which then I thought they just really, like, I think we were all that we did that, like, the second to last day, and we were all very emotional and just ready to, like, I don't know. It was a really powerful moment for us on set. But yeah, introducing Father Gil in that way and then having him dance to the exorcism with his metal music playing. And the metal music actually is surprisingly wasn't me. I had written that thinking I would have him dancing to, like, funk. I just thought it'd be funny if he was dancing to funk music. Like a really goofy funk song with a lot of bad words that I was going to try to, like, write for the movie.
Okay.
And Daniel, I cut it with, like, a temp song. I just put a temp funk song in. Daniel was like, dude, that's so not you. Like, I am a metalhead. I like grindcore. Like, I recorded the grindcore songs that play in the movie, and that song that's in the Scumbag teaser. Like, that's just me recording my terrible screamy music. And Daniel was like, dude, you don't give a shit about funk. You don't need to put a funk song in there. Go do your metal thing. And so I actually asked a few friends, Daniel and I asked if we asked his friend to record a song for the movie. So that's called, I think it's called Father Gil's theme, the Heretic Polka. And so that's what he's dancing to, is the Heretic Polka.
That's amazing. But I love that scene. You know, it establishes that persona, you know, that he's unconventional, and that he's also, like, really good at what he does to the point that, like, it doesn't look like he even has to try.
Yeah, doesn't even care. I like that he's got it so figured out that he actually can fast forward the song to the exact spot on a tape player. Like, most people won't even realize how hard a cassette player is to hit an exact spot on a song. But he's able to hit the exact spot so that he can say "The Power of Christ Compels You" as the song ends, which is vaguely based on the fact that I will slow down driving or speed up driving to get home at the perfect time to make the song stop so I can turn the car off at the right time. I just think that's cool. So I kind of wrote it into the movie. But one of my weird, stupid, like, ADD things that I do where I just have to, or like, I have to, like, have this rhythm to life. And I wanted to put that in the movie. I thought it would be a fun little moment. And then, yeah, just kind of like playing with that sort of punk metal theme throughout the movie here and there, just for fun. And then we were lucky enough to actually get some other fun songs for the movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The soundtrack is great too. So the other thing I wanted to kind of circle back to, you talked about, you know, like giving locations away and things like that. And I did notice, both in that scene and even other parts, you know, with the other filmmakers, that's one thing I really enjoy about Rebel Without a Crew, is it's not like your typical reality show where, you know, it's like Survivor or something where you have, you know, alliances and backstabbing and all this stuff where it's, you know, it's very cutthroat environment. And that is very much, I guess, the point of a lot of those shows. But here, like, everyone is supportive of each other. You know, everyone's, like, kind of helping each other out. You know, I think, like, there's at one point where it's like someone, like, was working late and forgot to pick up their camera equipment before the store closed. So,
yep.
You know, so one of the other filmmakers says, well, you know, you're doing interiors, I'm doing this, so you can borrow, you know, some of my stuff, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, you all just seem to help each other out and support each other rather than, you know, being pitted against one another.
Yeah, there's no way we would have done it if it was, I mean, none of us would have even been on the show if it was a competition. Just our personalities we're not those kind of people, and that's not obviously who they were looking for either. So I think if it had been a competition, like, Alejandro would have, he's said it many, many times, he would have been in it. If it was a competition, he would have probably even thrived stronger. But I wouldn't have even gone on the show. I just hate competition. I don't think any art should be made for competition personally. So we all kind of worked together, and it's actually sad that the show couldn't have been a little bit longer, because there were moments that I was certain would be on the show and didn't make it. Like at one point, Scarlett had a scene where she had to figure out how to do a stabbing. And we sat and like, we spent an hour and a half in one of our evenings after we had finished shooting, you know, messing with, we had a pillow set up and we put a bag of blood on it and we were stabbing it, trying to figure out like, how do you make blood come out of this bag? How do you spray it properly? How do you make it look like it's leaking? And we went through this whole process figuring out this stabbing. And it was just such a fun moment to figure out. There was moments where the Abaddon monster at the end of The Good Exorcist, trying to figure out how we were going to put together this like really cheap looking, fun, basket case style creature. That's what I wanted, was this really like low budget looking monster that was kind of pathetic on the floor. And originally that monster, the idea was I was actually going to be in a plastic bag, me with my head sticking out of the bag, and I was going to shave my head and my eyebrows and my mustache and everything and cover my face in mud and just look nasty. And the reality show was like, Josh, you can't shave your entire face. Like, we are pitching this show on you filmmakers as personas. We can't have you suddenly go from being, you know, Josh in the burger hat to this like weird looking monster of a man who's completely hairless. So they wouldn't let me do that. But Scarlett helped me figure that out too. Like how we set up that shot. And there was a lot of that. Bola and I figured out our camera by shooting the short film. It's actually on my YouTube. If you go to my YouTube, I think if you search like $7,000 or something like that, I think we called it like the $7,000 movie. Which is, it's just a stupid thing where I'm chained up on a chair and then Bola comes in and stabs me in the head. But that's how we learned how to use our camera, was, you know, setting that up, shooting it one evening before, I think the day before we were supposed to go film. And we all helped each other out a lot. There was a camaraderie between us all. Not to say we didn't get in each other's hair every once in a while and bug each other. And there were moments, you know, we wanted to strangle each other for certain things, but overall it was like being at camp. Like, we had a blast. Everyone was having a good time.
Yeah, that's awesome. It definitely.
And we just didn't have time for drama. It all happened over 3 weeks. So it was just a matter of, or 4 weeks. So it was just like, we showed up. Week one was like, go, 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 get your location, you know, write your storyboards, meet your cast, do this, do that. Week two, start filming, go, film. You only have 2 weeks to film, go. Third week, fourth week was like, all right, now everyone just chill and enjoy the fact that you're on the show. Now go cut a trailer for Robert to watch. Like that, which was, you know, stressful enough to begin with. So the whole thing was pretty intense. And, you know, we kind of thrived in that intensity. And it's actually taught me a lot about how intense it can get.
Yeah, that sounds like it. And yeah, it definitely looks like you guys are all having a good time. I mean, even though it's stressful, but yeah, you can definitely feel that camaraderie.
And there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of moments that were extremely stressful. A lot of tears were shed of like, oh my God, I can't do this. This is too hard. But then you kind of, you know, you take a nap, you take a half hour off, and you just go back and start again. Like, it's always just go, just do it. Like, you don't have an excuse. You just gotta keep going, because
right.
If you give up, then Robert comes out and says like, all right, go home. And no one wanted to disappoint Robert or ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. And it seems like he was very inspirational throughout
the process. Yeah, he was really helpful to some people more than, I mean, like, some people needed him more than others. Some people leaned on him for things. I mean, I saw him twice, maybe, the whole time. Like, I saw him the day we started, and he came to my set one day, and that was about it. We got his phone number and stuff like that, and we were supposed to text him. That was, like, part of the show they wanted. So at one point, they were like, my crew was like, Josh, it's been a week and a half. You haven't even sent Robert a text. What are you doing? Like, that's the stupidest thing in the world. You have this opportunity. Why aren't you messaging him? So I was like, all right, fine. I guess I'll message him. And I took a picture of Daniel laying on the floor naked with the teddy bear or in his bathrobe with the teddy bear and teddy bear puke all over his face. And I sent it to Robert and I said, this is what your $7,000 is being spent on. Are you proud or are you impressed or something like that? Daniel has the message. It's something like that. And then he sent back a message that was like, you know, $7,000 well spent or something like that. And So, you know, he was more like moral support or very helpful in regards to just, you know, saying, keep on keeping on, keep going.
Right.
He has this line at the beginning of the movie that really, or at the beginning of the show that really stuck with me, where he said, dance with creativity and let it take the lead. And that was a line that when he said it in person, while it was happening, I didn't even like think about it. I was just like, okay, there's a cheesy thing to say. That's corny. Like, who wrote that? And the more I met Robert, the more I'm like, oh, Robert definitely wrote that. That is 100% something Robert would say. But also, I don't know, it weirdly stuck with me for some reason over the years. And where every time I'm like, man, this sucks, I don't want to do this, I think about just taking that dance with creativity. And for some reason, it helps me kind of like chill and just dance, just be mellow with it. There's something very calm about it, where creativity sometimes to us is more stressful than we think. When we think about being creative, it's like, you got to be creative, you have to, you know, be clever and smart. But in reality, creativity is just this smooth thing that you should just let flow through you. And that's with moving into Scumbag. That's been my sort of my mantra, is anytime I get stressed or something isn't working, I'm like, well, what would be creative in this moment? What's the dance I want to do? And next thing I know, I'm vomiting blood onto my floor.
See, I haven't seen any of the other movies that that the other participants made yet, but from what I can see from filming, like there are a lot of props and things that have that sort of Rodriguez aesthetic. Like you've got you know, like a character with a, you know, with an eye patch, which just,
yeah, that's funny. I was going to bring this up earlier because you asked if the script changed based on, you know, working with Robert and being on the show and whatever. And the funniest thing is some of the stuff that changed was just Daniel going like, wouldn't it be cool if we had this because we're going to be making a movie with Robert Rodriguez. And I was actually on the plane texting with Daniel on my way to Rebel Without a Crew. I was on the plane and Daniel was like, what if we gave Maria an eye patch? I was like, an eye patch? Really? He's like, yeah, what if she has an eye patch? And instead of the paintings being sort of the reveal of her, we see inside the eye patch and her eye is all fucked up. And I was like, you know what? Let's do it. Let's try that. Let's go for it. And yeah, so then when I talked to Nina, who is Robert's costume designer, I was like, is there any way I could get an eye patch? And she's like, oh yeah, we've got so many eye patches here, take this one, and gave me like one of the cool Michelle Rodriguez eye patches. So the you know, priest costume was one from Dusk Till Dawn or something like that, not the one that Daniel wears, but the one that Father Raymond wears. And so, you know, we had access to that stuff. But if we didn't have access to that stuff, it was all stuff that you could just get anywhere. Robert is really good at figuring out sort of iconic things. And one of the things we figured out on The Good Exorcist is Daniel and I sort of just decided in every shot we wanted it to have something kind of iconic, which is based on Robert and what he does, but it's sort of based on all of the filmmakers we love. You know, I grew up with Tim Burton being my favorite director, and obviously everything Tim Burton does just has this iconic Burton feel. Mm-hmm. And so when we were, you know, thinking of anything that happened in The Good Exorcist, we were like, well, this is a stupid movie. I mean, like, we know it's a stupid movie, so we can get away with anything. So if something comes up that we can use and is iconic, let's use it. Like, write it into the script. Who cares? Like, let's find a way. So we easily, you know, when we show the animated sequence, we easily could have had him just show it on a cell phone or on whatever, but we had access to this old crappy TV and a VCR, and I was just like, well, we can get a VHS. Actually, the VCR was from, that was one of the props I picked from Robert's thing, and it actually, don't tell Robert this, but it had a tape in it that was like an 80s what are those called, workout, what are those, like,
oh, like an exercise,
like an tape? Aerobics, yeah. Tape. Yeah, like one of those.
Like a Jane Fonda aerobics. Or something.
It's Jane Fonda. That's what it is, I think. A Jane Fonda workout tape in it. And I actually took it home. I stole Robert's Jane Fonda tape. So I've got that going for me. But everything we came up with, we were just like, well, what could be iconic in this scene? So like Maria's coat, the rose skull, it means nothing. At the time when we filmed the movie, it meant nothing to us. Now, I've been writing the sequel, Father Gill and the Daughters of Lilith, and the rose skull is like a massive part of that movie. But that was just a design Daniel came up with. We called up our buddy Strauss, and who does print, and we were like, hey man, can you print this on a coat? He was like, sure. So they went to the thrift store, got this cool yellow coat with fringes, and painted it on there, or printed it on there. It means nothing, but it looks awesome, right? Like you see the rose skull and you're like, that's cool. And now it's led to this entire second movie having this rose skull that means something to me personally, and has built this idea of Maria and who she is and what I want the sequel to be. And there's a lot of those things, like the eye patch, like the rose skull, like the car that Maria drives. Originally, they were supposed to just drive Father Gill's car. But the guy who plays Mr. Willows, John Barron, he was like, hey, I have this really cool car. If you guys would want to use it in the movie anywhere, I would love to put it in the movie. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess we're going to write it into the movie. And Daniel and I sat down and we're like, but why? Why is it in the movie? And we realized, like, well, Maria's getting paid to work there. Her room and board is paid for. She probably is making a little bit of cash. She'd have a cool car. Why not? Like, that's her only possession she owns is that car. So we just wrote it into the script and rolled with it.
Yeah, that's cool. Because you have not one, but two, like, awesome cars in this movie.
That other car, that Lincoln, was actually on the grounds. And it barely run. Oh, that car was a pain to get running. I'd sit there and mess with the battery, and Daniel would be trying to start it, and we'd just be like pounding on the car, just trying to get it to go. And eventually it would kick on and he would be able to get it to go. That's why in the movie, he does this really fun peel out at the very end, which is totally not on purpose. That peel out just totally happened because that car did not run properly. But I think eventually when we finished the movie, we couldn't get it to run again. And Daniel and I had to push that Lincoln all the way to the back of the lot, which was a pain in the ass and like 90 degree Texas sun. But yeah, it was fun. The whole process was fun. And getting those kind of iconic pieces was really important to me, just because why not? And bled itself into Greywood's plot. Whenever we were doing a scene, we were just like, well, what can we put in this scene? Like, what will make this shot look more fun to look at? What's an iconic piece to have?
Yeah. And that's what makes it a movie, right? Instead of just, you know, a couple of guys screwing around with the camera. And there's nothing wrong with just, you know, screwing around with the camera and having fun. But to take just that extra beat and say, how do we make this shot more interesting? What can we put in here that's going to, you know, draw someone's eye? I mean, that's the art behind film.
Yeah, for me, it was sort of that Simpsons mentality. They made the Simpsons yellow because they thought people would be flipping through the channels and then be like, oh, what's this ugly thing? I'm going to watch it. And a lot of the movie, that's sort of what we were shooting for. Was like, knowing that no one is watching it the way that the movie was intended, like, I know no one is flipping through the channels anymore and going to stumble onto The Good Exorcist. Like, very rarely is that going to happen. However, I liked the idea of making a movie like that, because it's the only time I'm ever going to get to do that in my life. So why not take advantage of it now while I'm using Robert's money versus my own?
Awesome. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I'm just curious. Do you have a favorite Robert Rodriguez movie?
Oh, I go back and forth with Rodriguez. This is the hardest question because I love answering it, but it's so difficult. Right now, in this very moment, I've got to go with Desperado. Like, I'm all into Desperado right now. I'm a huge, like, there's just something about that movie that's working for me in this moment. However, if you had asked me 6 months ago, I probably would have said From Dusk Till Dawn. And if you'd asked me 6 months before that, and up until, like, you know, 10 years before that, the first Rodriguez movie I really saw that made me, it was one of those movies that made me go like, okay, when I graduate, I want to go make movies, I think. Like, it was one of those movies that made that bucket list reason to have, that one movie was Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I saw that movie in high school, and I went to a very religious private school, and I actually thought I was going to be a pastor, believe it or not. And I saw that movie and I was like, oh man, fuck being a pastor. I want to go make action movies. Like, this is cool. And it just had that like anime vibe and it did whatever it wanted. It never cared what the audience thought. I just loved that about it. And, but I jump around. I'm just like a general Rodriguez fan, and it's been really fun because now my kids are, I have two young kids who have been all about Spy Kids like the past few months. And then, you know, he released We Can Be Heroes, which my 5-year-old, who was 4 when it came out, he was like obsessed with We Can Be Heroes. And I'm like, hey man, I literally was on this set. Like I shot a movie here, son. Like, look at this. This is, I'm cool. And he's like, I don't care, Dad. I just want to watch the kids. But yeah, it's been, I jump around, but I will say the best thing Robert ever did was Rebel Without a Crew, the book, like taking that adventure and making El Mariachi and then being willing to share the experience with so many people through that book is inspiring to thousands and thousands of people, but also just entertaining as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm a big fan of his work too. I'm kind of like you, where I will sort of go back and forth, you know, from Dusk Till Dawn.
What's your favorite right now in this moment?
Right now, I'm kind of partial towards Planet Terror.
Yeah, man, Planet Terror. I just watched Planet Terror, and because I went through a big Tarantino phase, like where I just watched a bunch of his movies over and over, like on repeat. I was watching Inglourious Basterds for a while, and then I wasn't a big fan of Death Proof because I made the mistake of going to the midnight screening on Halloween or whatever it was when it came out. Was it like a winter release? I don't remember. Whenever that released, I went to the midnight screening. By the time I got to Death Proof, I was so tired and so fried. And just listening to women talk for an hour for the first half of that movie, I was so bored and falling asleep. And I did not like that movie for the longest time. And then went back to it right before Rebel Without a Crew. I actually went and watched Death Proof again and was like, this is a masterpiece. Like, what, was I an idiot? Like, this is an amazing movie. Like, this is an actual true grindhouse movie. Like, this is the only modern grindhouse movie. Every other grindhouse movie is trying to be a grindhouse movie, but doesn't actually quite understand why they existed, how they were made, that rhythm of like filler. Utter filler to get to these like moments, and Tarantino just got it, and oh, that movie rocked. So then as soon as I got home from Rebel Without a Crew, because I wasn't allowed to watch any of the any movies while I was on set because of union rules and whatever, I put on Planet Terror, and oh my god, that movie is like one of the most fun movies ever. It is just a blast.
It really is. Yeah, it's a ton of fun. So that one's kind of the one, you know, lately. Alita Battle Angel really blew me away.
I was not
expecting to enjoy it so much.
I saw it in the theater because I actually, there was a moment where I sat in a director's chair on the Alita set editing The Good Exorcist. Like, I was literally sitting on the set right where that fountain is, where they're doing the, like, roller thing, whatever the game is called.
It's not Rollerball, but it's,
yeah, but whatever it's called. Yeah, they're playing that game. I was sitting in that location, which is like a $7 million location, just this little set. It's like $7 million set, editing my $7,000 movie. And it was one of the coolest moments of my life. And so I went and saw that in the theater right away, and then I really enjoyed it the first time I saw it, but it wasn't until I rewatched it with my kids that it really like struck me how kind of brilliant that movie is, how messed up it is. Like, that is a R-rated movie hidden in a PG-13 robot science fiction movie. She literally rubs dog blood on her face and somehow got away with it being a PG-13 movie. That blows my mind, but I love that movie. Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing. But from Dusk Till Dawn is probably the one that I've seen the most. That's just an all-time classic. And it's two movies in one, because you get it's a really good like crime thriller.
Uh-huh.
And then it turns into a really good vampire film.
It does, and it does it so like seamlessly abrupt. That's a weird contradiction, but it is. It's like all of a sudden happens, and yet you just go along for that ride. It's so good, and the performances are so good.
Just to kind of recap, when should people be keeping an eye out for Greywood's plot and
Scumbag, and The Good Exorcist is available on Amazon, and it's actually going. I think I can say that it's going to be coming out through Troma. So we got a, I did a distribution with Troma, so we're going to do Blu-rays and a bunch of stuff like that. Lloyd has been great. Lloyd Kaufman has been great, and everyone at Troma has been so awesome to be patient with me. But next weekend or the weekend after, Daniel and I are going to be doing this. You know, we the Rebel Without a Crew exists, and it's its own thing, and it's the behind the scenes of The Good Exorcist, but it's wrapped in this bow of reality TV. Daniel and I want to do our own kind of take on the behind the scenes structure and do something different. So our concept is, Daniel and I are going to get together and we're going to have a list of questions, and we're going to set up like a multicam shoot and get really drunk and talk about making The Good Exorcist. And then we're going to intersplice it with actual footage I filmed on set and cell phone behind the scenes footage and stuff like that, and kind of tell our story on how The Good Exorcist got made and what happened after, and like kind of what a true independent film looks like when you're forced or kind of pushed into making this thing, and then what you do with it afterwards. So that's our plan, is to get really drunk and tell stories, and then show behind the scenes and animations of, like, you know, the stories that I don't have anything filmed. I can animate it and show kind of like what happened. So that's going to be hopefully coming out with Troma. But if anyone has any questions, I'm on Twitter at Josh Stifter, Instagram at Flush Studios. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everything. So on YouTube, leave me a comment on YouTube. However you want to get in contact with me, flushstudios@gmail.com. Send me questions that you would like us to talk about, and we'll get really drunk and try to answer them. Greywood's plot is hitting film festivals now, but the little hidden secret is, if you want to see it now, patreon.com/flushstudios. Sign up for whatever you can, and the movie, there's the film festival cut is available on Patreon. Scumbag wraps filming hopefully this weekend. I'm gonna wrap filming, but it's a fluid process, so we'll see. It'll probably go a couple more weeks, and then that will probably be out at the end of 2021. 1st of November, my short film is hitting film festivals right now. And youtube.com/flushstudios for all the things of the past that I've done, including this year. I did a morning video every day from January 1st till about early May or mid-April or something like that. I did a video every single morning, like a diary of filmmaking and whatever. And then I stopped because I had to get Scumbag done. It was just taking up too much time. But there's a ton of great stuff if you like to learn more about independent filmmaking. I spill the beans.
Great. Awesome. Yeah. So keep an eye out for all of that. I'll put links in the show notes, as always, to a lot of that stuff, so people can check it out more easily. And Josh, I am definitely going to send you some questions, because that sounds
like a riot.
It's going
to be so fun. Yeah, it's going to be so. Daniel and I get kind of goofy when we start drinking, so I figured this is a good time to, and we're probably going to do it from the Scumbag set that I have down here. So I'll do a multicam setup, and we're going to just like have a fun time, tell some stories, and hopefully break down the process from a very insider point of view. I remember there's an audio commentary on the South Park movie Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, where they just get drunk doing an audio commentary, or maybe it was the other movie, Orgasmo. One of the two of them, they get drunk, and it's really funny. But both of those audio commentaries, if you haven't listened to them, the South Park guys, their audio commentaries are so funny. I highly recommend them. That's what we want to do, but in visual form.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Definitely looking forward to that. I've seen a few of those. I think there was a mushroom commentary on one movie that I bought recently.
Nice.
Great. So check out Josh Stifter online and Flush Studios. Check out his Patreon and keep an eye out for The Good Exorcist on Blu-ray. I'm definitely going to order one for myself as soon as it's available. Josh,
awesome.
thanks so much for coming out today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you everyone out there for joining me for another episode. Please go check out The Good Exorcist. Keep your eyes out for Greywood's plot and Scumbag. Follow me at Finn Horror on Twitter. I will drop news as soon as I hear about the Troma release for The Good Exorcist Blu-ray. And please tune in next week right here for another episode of Not Suitable for Anyone.